I continue to be, to this day, John Atack, despite all of my attempts to be otherwise. And I'm delighted to welcome a man who has become my good friend through these conversations, Dr. Stephen Moffick. You're a professor as well, aren't you? You're all sorts of things. It's incredible, the eminence that you have achieved. You have. Go on, you can admit it. You can tell us.
I can't comment on myself, so.
Best not to, really. The last time we spoke, towards the end of the conversation, the question of psychotropic drugs came up, and it seemed to me to be a very interesting idea to talk to somebody who is in the psychiatric profession, and who probably has an opinion about such things. So tell us something. I'm going to put one thing in, which is that we owe the word psychedelic, as I understand it, to Aldous Huxley. And he was very insistent that the proper word should be psychedolic. So we're all saying it wrong.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You know, yeah, you're bringing up a really big and important topic. And I guess I sort of forgot a little bit that we would probably talk about this, but you could see I'm dressed in black here, which is sort of a Johnny Cash way of dressing, but
the psychiatrist in black
sort of fits my mood. There's so many problematic conflicts in the world and within the American government, and deaths occurring in the Middle East, and so not so much uplifting stuff. And then there was an episode yesterday at our synagogue. We were doing Torah study, Old Testament study for the week, and one of the people there seemed to start hallucinating, and we found out he had been taking ketamine, and whether ketamine, which may be a psychedelic, maybe not, was throwing him off like this, and we had to call emergency to help. So the importance of psychedelics, I think, are twofold. One is, are they a therapeutic tool that we don't have now? And suggestions from the 50s and 60s indicate that they are.
Yeah.
Can they also even help with bigger world problems? And then thirdly, how dangerous are they, as I was implying with the episode from yesterday? So
can I just throw in that, of course, in the news recently has been the death of Matthew Perry, the Friends actor, and it's now been announced that it was an overdose of ketamine, and he was taking ketamine therapeutically because he had drug problems and was suffering from depression. And in Germany for some years now, ketamine coma has been employed with chronic depression, with long-term depression, and they'll put you into coma for 5 days on this stuff, and you will K-hole. You'll have an experience, a hallucinogenic experience. And it sounds really awful to me, I must say. I'm getting old. This is very much in the news at the moment, your experience at the synagogue and what happened to poor Matthew Perry.
Yeah, it's maybe it's clearer what happened to him, and it seems probably right that ketamine was involved, and of course he had difficulties with many other drugs, and that's the essence of most psychedelics and most psychiatric medications, and maybe most medicines in general. They have their problems and side effects too. So, careful and therapeutic usage is still a challenge. Again, for psychiatry per se, to have better medications to help is so crucial, because we've probably run the gamut with what already exists. And the promise that was developing in the 50s and 60s was enormous. And of course, there's historical information that people have been taking psychedelic for probably thousands of years. And maybe that helped them, but maybe it also had side effects along the way. And But getting better control and better therapeutic control is really important. There's another recent report out, or journalistic report, I don't know how scientific this is, that the use of the microdoses of LSD is sort of being used like meditation, you know, just kind of cool down and bliss out. By taking a very small microdose of LSD is becoming more and more popular in the United States. So in a way, that's not treating any psychiatric illness, in quotes, although I don't know where to draw the line with psychiatric illness anyways, but that's more an enhancer perhaps of mental health, taking such a microdose. So, But the promises there, and there is more careful research going on, especially in regards to difficult to treat PTSD, depression, death anxiety, and so forth. And you know, we mentioned ketamine because ketamine in essence is the only one out there that, again, may or may not be characterized well as a psychedelic. You know, when I was in the midst of my clinical work, ketamine was a big danger when you heard somebody had taken it. You know, it'd been around a long time as an anesthetic, so you could potentially get it on the street. And if people did, accidentally or not, they really had difficulty hallucinating, getting into trouble, angry, and we didn't even know how to treat it when it occurred at the time, so that it eventually came out as a possible treatment for difficult to treat depression and maybe a psychedelic that was sort of a revelation. And because it was already approved as an anesthetic, it didn't need approval to be used in psychiatry, as odd as that might sound. You know, once a drug is out there and approved, it can be used. Now, you can get in trouble for this, potentially legally, but legally, in its essence, you can use a medication that's out there for other purposes than it was approved by, as odd as that sounds. So that's what happened with ketamine. And now we have all these ketamine clinics sprouting in the United States. It reminds me just of another cure that comes out that everybody's excited with, and then you find out the problems with it. But we've got all these ketamine clinics sprouting out, and some of them don't have any physicians or psychiatrists involved, actually. Some of them do. Some of them are much more careful. Some of them provide good therapy at the same time the person is taking the ketamine. Sometimes not. But the people that benefit are just so striking because they haven't benefited from other treatments. Sometimes it's very quick, the benefits, and they last. And so the promise is for sure there. In research, in the research settings, like Johns Hopkins is one place, they're focusing more on the psychedelics that are not approved, like MDMA, sort of ecstasy, the party drug, and which any therapist who used that with patients before it was illegal in the United States was also almost shocked at how much they helped.
Yeah, we had this statement from a psychiatrist who is also a psychotherapist who said that he'd seen more transformation in a single dose of MDMA than in a year of therapy.
Yeah.
So for some people, and I really want to underline this, that we are not recommending the use of these drugs. What we are saying is they may have usefulness, and we shouldn't be blind to that. And I would say, you know, if you are going to go to a ketamine clinic for treatment, then you need there to be somebody medically qualified involved. That's my humble opinion.
Oh, yeah, that would be my professional opinion for sure.
Yeah.
Because again, you have these unanticipated or anticipated side effects, and sometimes dangerous, and Matthew Perry's case, potentially deadly. But you know, whatever it looks like they can do therapeutic is so dramatic and so different, and these medications, these drugs, these plants, are so different from what's already out there. We just got to try to plow through this without them getting illegal again or not approved. There's just too much promise here, I think, but needs to be careful. You know, and the public is obviously experimenting on their own too, which is both a plus and a minus. You know, you can, at least in the United States, you can get lots of these drugs in the underground and experiment with, quotes, different doses. And so we have to try to learn from the public that's doing this on its own. And of course, maybe the other big plus and minus nowadays that wasn't occurring in the 50s and 60s is that the commercial potential of these is focused on now in a way it didn't in the 50s and 60s. So these investors are banking lots of investment funds on companies that can develop pill forms and more precise dosage, and think there's, if they get approved, you know, from the FDA, it's going to really be a financial boon to them. And once you get control of medicine by business, there's always major problems. I mean, I guess our whole medical system in the United States is controlled by big business. And for psychedelics to eventually be controlled by them is going to be really problematic. So it's another challenge, but that's different this time around. And of course, the investment gives the money to do more research. So it's positive in that way. There have been some people who have been doing this research for years, very carefully, not wanting to make a fortune, any of that. And those can be relied on for good information. But again, when business gets involved, you have to be a little suspect. What's their motive, to make a big profit or to help people, you know? So,
and I mean, in Colorado now, psilocybin has been legalized. And a friend of mine who's over in Colorado was showing me some of the advertising that's already in preparation. And you're getting little packets of sweeties, you know, in the same way that we've now got cannabis gummies, THC gummies. And, I generally think that prohibition is a bad idea. But we have to put limits on that. Was it right to prohibit arsenic, cyanide, strychnine, warfarin? Are these things that, well, of course, these are things that should be regulated. Something that can kill you, something that's a cumulative poison, a heavy metal like arsenic, for example. It seems right to me that there should be regulations, just as there are regulations about the purity of alcohol. But it's worth saying that during the Volstead Act years, from what, 1919 to 1933 in the US, the prohibition of alcohol caused many more deaths from alcohol than had existed before. In fact, I think death rates more than doubled because bathtub gin was being made, because, you know, there wasn't regulation, and alcohol being potentially and quite easily such a deadly drug. I think most people don't realize that if you drink a bottle of vodka in 10 minutes, it's very likely to kill you. You know, it's a drug. It's a hard drug. It's an addictive drug. And it has a physical, physiological effect. It destroys cellular tissue to do what it's doing. But that's not going to stop me from drinking, so don't worry about that. But alcohol, I think, shows a model that we need, especially with addictive drugs. And again, most of the class of hallucinogens, psychedelics, are non-addictive. We used to, when I first looked at this kind of stuff when I was a teenager, there used to be, we have addiction and we have dependency. And addiction means that you'll have physiological withdrawal symptoms. So coffee, good example of an addictive drug, a hard drug. If you stop drinking coffee and you're habituated to drinking coffee, you'll probably get a headache. That's a fairly typical symptom. If you are coming away from opioids or opiates, then your bowels will become rather looser. You know, so these are physical things that will happen to you. Then you have dependency. And back then, the 60s, the early 70s, the thought was that cocaine was a drug that caused dependency. That was, it was very Moorish. People liked to take it. And it was not held at that time to be addictive. Attitudes have now really changed about that. It is an addictive drug. But we get into that grey area. It's said that about 10% of cannabis users are addicted. And yet, you know, having known quite a lot of people who use cannabis, it seems to be rather used in our society these last few decades. I've yet to meet anybody who said, oh God, I've got to have a spliff. You know, it doesn't seem to, yeah, maybe there are such people, but I haven't met them. Whereas with heroin, that seems kind of more. So there are degrees of dependence, there are degrees of addiction. And I do think we should err on the side of caution and keep what used to be called anecdotal evidence, which these days we're calling real world evidence, find out what the general response is, and also have very precise studies looking into the effects of these drugs. As you say, back in the 50s and 60s, you had these two sources for hallucinogens. One was the CIA, who spread it throughout the culture. That's where Ken Kesey got his LSD from. Originally, he was a student on a study that was being run by a front group who were probably unaware that they were working for the CIA. The CIA are a bit secretive, I'm told. So you had LSD being launched into the culture massively, hundreds of thousands of trips being, because the CIA were really curious about using this in mind control. But you also had the medical usage, Stanislaus Grof, particularly in Czechoslovakia, who basically formed his own cult group, as far as I'm concerned, using hyperventilation, which I don't think is a safe or sensible technique, where you breathe too quickly and, you know, your brain gets a bit fuzzy. I don't think it's good for you. The Rajneeshis do it. It's a part of their practice. They till they go. But so he replaced it from there, but he'd got some interesting work. And again, psychiatrists in the US, in Canada, and in Britain in the 50s and 60s, I knew a psychiatrist when I was a teenager in the 60s, a newer psychiatrist who had been on the research programs, and she'd come away terrified of the use of LSD. And when I quizzed her about this, she said, yes, we gave it to an 8-year-old boy. It was awful. And I kind of looked and went, you gave it to an 8-year-old boy?
Mm-hmm.
Don't think that was a very good idea. And if we look culturally, yeah, it's an aside, but as a kid, I was very interested in the Mesoamerican peoples, particularly the Nahuatl peoples, the Olmec, Totonac, Toltec, Mixtec, Aztec, these groups of people who, of course, were the prototype for a culture that uses hallucinogens massively. And you have the Mezcal people, like the Huichol in Mexico, you had the Mayan people. And I was fascinated to find that in the Aztec culture, they had peyotl, mezcal cactus, they had psilocybin mushrooms, and a brew that they called ololoquai, which is morning glory seeds, but it's the Mexican morning glory, not the South African one, just in case you were thinking, Steve, of grinding up some seeds there. And you actually had to belong to the right caste of society. Each caste of society had its own drug. So if I remember rightly, the LSD was used by the warriors and the psilocybin was used by the priests and the mezcal was used by rank and file such as myself. And the word of caution, and I think we need some words of caution around this topic, is this was a tremendously, in its way, a tremendously violent society. And they thought that if they didn't rip people's hearts out, then Weasley Posley would not bring the sun up every day and they'd be in a lot of trouble. So I hadn't really thought about this. This is really in your subject area, social psychiatry, that if you infuse a whole society with a substance, then that society, you know, the set of beliefs of that culture, for example, the Huichol, with whom I'm fascinated, are in central Mexico and make amazing, beautiful art. I've got a couple of...
Yeah, we got it all over the walls in our house. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
I saw a show at the Southwestern in LA in the 80s, 88, and I was just blown away because it wasn't like, oh, we're looking at primitive art. It was like, oh, we're looking at Matisse, and you know, these people are really great at what they do. But they ran away quite rightly from the conquistador and ended up, I think, 300 miles away from where they'd started. So they have to trek out every year to go and get the peyote. And then the thing that got me in finding out about them was three sets of anthropologists had visited them, one in around 1900, one in, I think, 1977, and then one later on. And they were told three completely different sets of myths. And when the third one arrived and said, hang on, the two guys before me have been told different things, he said, well, if a stranger came to you and wanted your secrets, would you tell them? That's the first point we'd like to make. The second point is, for the Huichol, they make their own religion individually because they have experiences directly when they take mezcal and they interpret. A bit more like the Judaism than Christianity, because in Judaism you have Besho, where you are meant to think about what the text might mean rather than the literalism that's crept into Christianity about text. And so with Huichol, in each generation, they are developing and changing their mythology. Their relationship with the gods is direct and immediate.
Well, you know, just as an aside, before we went on the air, you and I were talking about the Eastern religions and spirituality, because we've been involved in a book development about that, and for which I'm the lead editor. But one of the things that really struck me as I learned more about Hinduism is sort of just like you said about the Huichol experiences being so personal. Well, in Hinduism, people sort of pick their own sub gods.
Yeah, which one of 800 do you want?
Yeah, it's almost the same principle. There's, you know, kind of an overall belief system, but not really lots of or any controlling priests or clergy and people. There's so many sub gods that can be chosen, and that's what people do. And I think it's not to say that Hinduism can't contribute to violence, but and I guess we see that potential danger in India now in regard to more conservative and fundamentalist Hinduism. But it seems to be much less from Hinduism. This potential for violence seems to be less. And as far as anti-Semitism goes, in a prior book about that, we seem to find out that there hasn't been any anti-Semitism by Hinduism, and you may be unique in the world. So there is, I think there's something important about what you just said about being able to develop your own individual religious beliefs within an overall kind of, not structure, but content that has some history and things to learn, but then developing how it fits you the best. So,
and Hinduism is a collection of religions which vary so tremendously. And you have the great intellectual Hindus, the second prime minister of India, Radhakrishnan, was a philosopher and scholar who wrote an amazing book, which is, you know, I've not managed to read yet. I'm busy, but I bought it about 2 years ago with the intention of reading it, where he compares Western philosophy and Eastern philosophy. And I think you tend to find this the same thing in all societies. There is what you might call a peasant religion, which will be devotional usually. You know, that so even Buddhism, which for, you know, again is a set of religions, not a religion. To me, it's completely in conflict, the idea that Buddhists would worship a Buddha or Bodhisattva. That seems a complete contradiction to me from the original canon of the Buddha. But they do, and the majority do. So, you know, there'll be Amida Buddhists, or, you know, the jolly fat Buddha that the Chinese we see there, or the Tibetans with their Avalokiteshvara, the idea that the Dalai Lama is the Bodhisattva of compassion in his 14th incarnation at the moment. I must say, reading the biographies of the Dalai Lamas, they seem like very different people to me. Because one of them used to go to the top of the Potala, the enormous palace in Lhasa, and he'd pee on the people below. You know, I can't see the present one doing that. So maybe he's gone through a lot of personality changes as he's evolved through his lifetimes. I don't know. But so you have a kind of peasant religion, which is devotional, bhakti, as the Hindus would say, bhakti yoga, Krishna. Consciousness is a form of bhakti yoga. It's devotional. Then you'll have a kind of form that's magical, where people are trying to get the gods to do what they want and control and dominate them, which I've always thought was rather childish personally, but I hope no Aleister Crowley fans are watching this, because they'll put a spell on me and who knows what happened then, little voodoo dolls. And then you have a kind of intellectual or mystical perception of religion. And I find this in Islam, I find it in Hinduism, in Buddhism, in Christianity and Judaism. Wherever you go, there will be a forming of the religious beliefs that fits to the temperament and character of the individuals following them. So at the worst end of this in India in the 19th century, you had the Thuggees, a sect who would use the awful drug Datura, which was also used by members of the Manson family. A variant of it. And they were reckoned to have murdered at least 40,000 people, the Thuggees. They would strangle travelers and steal all their stuff. And that was in the worship of Kali, the black goddess sometimes called. So you've got that end of the religion, which, as you say, might not be anti-Semitic necessarily, though I would caution anybody to read Savitri Devi before making too certain a statement about Hinduism, because she was a Nazi who greatly influenced the modern BJP, the ruling party in India. So there has been some anti-Semitism, most certainly. But
certainly individuals, yeah.
But not on the scale that we've seen in, you know, the awful scale that we've seen in Europe and America, and sadly, you know, in the last century in the Middle East as well. A place that, you know, Islam was largely tolerant of Judaism and Christianity until Hitler's folk started stirring things up in the Arab countries in the 1930s. And
yeah, well, you know,
bad to worse.
You remind me about another chapter in the Eastern Religions and Spirituality book, which is the last one. It's on omnism, OMISM, which is new to me, but it's apparently a small movement where the quotes best of all religions are pulled.
A perennial together. Philosophy, like Baha'i, yeah. Is another one, yeah.
Yeah, and I think this is even broader and less broader in its attempt to pick out the beauty and the pluses of all religions. And I must say, I ended up having to help with a chapter, but the main author, Ramo Rao Goganini, a psychiatrist, is one of the most beautiful human beings and psychiatrists I've ever met. And originally he was Hindu and moved toward this broader belief system. And it gives you, if you ever meet him and or read what he wrote, it gives you lots of hope. But on the other hand, there's not too many people I've run across like him. He's just kind of full of goodness. You know, he has his own, I'm sure, private moments, which I don't know about. But I think what we're getting at by talking about both religions and psychedelics is, how do we overcome the deficits in human nature?
Yes.
And I think we try to do it both ways. And now we have a third component that may be trying to help our human nature, which is AI, artificial intelligence. Mm. And so I think without realizing it, you know, we humans somehow recognize our deficits or limitations, and we're trying to find ways to overcome them, such as our innate fear to fear the other, somebody who's different physically or mentally, and we tend to fear that person right off the bat, and it takes time and cognitive effort to overcome that, or a psychedelic or a religious belief. But we've got these limitations in our human nature. And despite all the technical advances, amazing technical advances that have happened in recent decades, our human nature, as far as I can tell, has barely changed at all. And so we still have these dangers and limitations, and psychedelics is one search to control that. You know, you mentioned, well, what about, you didn't really say this, but I was thinking, well, what about putting medication in the water for people, psychedelic? You know, that idea came up with lithium, actually, for bipolar disorder, because it does naturally occur in some water. And well, if we put the right amount in the water, would it help prevent manic depressive disorder from occurring? And that would be pretty tricky, but if it really did that without causing side effects, I mean, wouldn't we want that to happen? I don't know. So sometimes the same idea comes up with psychedelics. Oh, if we put a small amount of LSD in some sort of liquid that most everybody took, like water, would that help us have more positive cosmic connections and thereby be less violent? I mean, again, that's never going to happen, and maybe that has more problems. I shouldn't say that. Maybe something like that would happen in a dictatorship country, that certain drugs are psychic.
There is a peculiar effect that has been asserted from studies in the US that is to do with taking lead out of gasoline, out of petrol, as we call it, and that it said that IQ levels rose every decade, that the 100 point, the average point, went up decade by decade from Alfred Binet and co starting all of that in about 1900. Though Binet thought it was shocking that you should compare two people, you know, that IQ testing was meant to be to see the progress that an individual made. And I absolutely agree with that point. But nonetheless, then we started seeing a drop in the 1990s for the first time. And it may be pegged against the availability of particulate lead in the atmosphere. You know, I'm told that having your water running through lead pipes is not as dangerous because it's been broken down. And so it was used in petrol to keep engines running smoothly. And it may well have actually influenced a whole generation. So that idea, that's the sort of example of putting something in the water supply, that's putting something in the air supply. And, you know, that thought of spiking everybody with a drug, Soma. We come back to Aldous Huxley, whichever route we're going to travel here. He also, of course, wrote a book called The Perennial Philosophy. So we could have roped him into that as well. But this idea of Soma, and there is now a drug called Soma, of course, they disregarded him. And there is meant to be traditionally in Hinduism a drug called Soma, and many people have searched to try and find out what it was.
Yeah.
But this idea, as Prozac started to march into our culture in the late 1980s, I did start wondering whether we were dealing with a form of Soma that would actually decrease people's experience in some way, that, you know, their experience would come into a narrower band. They wouldn't get as distressed, but they wouldn't be as joyful either. And that we've now seen that, you know, it's a standard in our culture. And it's a matter of whether you can deal with the lows. And, you know, look at the Ukraine and what's happening there, and Gaza and what's happening there, and somehow manage to maintain, a reasonable confidence in humanity, which is quite difficult. Well, you know, when that becomes overwhelming and what you do, and there does seem a danger of sort of normalizing people, that thing of the 1950s where people would go to a psychiatrist and say, make me normal. And it's like, you know, when people tell me they're neurodivergent, it's like, I've never met anybody who wasn't, you know, not yet.
No. Yeah, you got this whole spectrum of people out there, right?
Yeah.
That's why I think DSM, our diagnostic manual from the United States, you know, draws this line between what's, quote, abnormal, and uses a very interesting term that I don't think is talked about enough. Uses the term disorders. Doesn't use the term illness. It uses the term disorder. Those aren't the same words. Very different. And but the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, draws this line where you can diagnose a certain disorder, and then presumably everybody else is more or less normal. I don't think that's true from my experience in work or living. Mm. I think there's a spectrum going on. Mm. And yeah, you can draw a line where it's more obvious that treatment is necessary, but it's still on a spectrum. And so, as you just said about neurodiversity, you know, we're so broad as a people, and I don't think there's nothing that cuts us off from these are the, quotes, crazy people, and these are the ones who are normal. I don't think that's true, and I think that limits our perspective of how to help. And that's been one of my goals in social psychiatry, is to open up our perspective broadly, not to say everybody needs psychiatric treatment, although that's been positive by lots of different people. Everybody should get psychotherapy, for instance. I wouldn't even agree with that. But I think it's understanding how we're all different, but all connected, you know, and some of us have better strengths than others. Some of us have better weaknesses than others. But from a psychiatric standpoint, we can educate and help with what we learn. And then it's up to the public, you know, to take that as they will, up to a point where what you do endangers other people, which, going back to what you first mentioned about alcohol, is a gigantic problem with alcohol. When I worked in prison part-time, the highest prevalence population-wise with some sort of psychiatric disorder was those who had a problem with alcohol, because they kind of lost control of what they were doing, especially driving a car. And so it was even more that they were dangerous to other people than dangerous to themselves. Although, as you point out, the physical effects of alcohol over time are tremendous. So it's one of the most dangerous drugs out there, but, you know, somehow got to be approved more in general psychiatry and society, you know, but it's quite dangerous over time. And but over how much is used.
The Lancet in November 2010, if I remember rightly, published a Professor David Nutt's study from Imperial College, which was the most wide-ranging study of the personal and social effects of drugs. And they rated alcohol as socially the most dangerous and physically the most dangerous drug. Cocaine and heroin trail behind. I think they gave 72 points to alcohol and 54 to heroin and 53 to cocaine, something like that. And I'm not sure about it. I think it's better to separate the individual effect and the social effect. I think they, you know, trying to amalgamate them through a statistical model bothers me, you know, standard deviations and all of that stuff. I mean, what kind of deviation is standard? It's a ridiculous idea. Forgive me. But when we look at the direct effect, as I said before, the idea of licensing and saying, you know, there's a professor at Columbia, Carl Hart, whose books I find quite fascinating. This is a man who grew up in projects, I think, in Florida, who was led to believe that the problem of racism was a problem that was to do with drugs, that black people were being held down by the use of drugs in their communities, particularly crack cocaine.
And the criminal activity in the background that was supporting that, right?
Absolutely appalling.
Almost intended to have an adverse effect on black communities.
Yeah, and looking at the idea that, you know, if you've got powder cocaine, you'll get one kind of sentence. If you've got crack cocaine, which is exactly the same drug, you can get 100 times greater sentence, you know, by quantity. It's awful things happen. But Hart joined the military and afterwards went on the GI Bill and became a professor at Columbia, which is fairly prestigious, and said that he spent the first 10 years of his work trying to prove the bad effects of drugs, and he wasn't able to. And so he started shifting his view, and he said, you know, there's a mythology. I was actually reading one of David Nutt's books when he talked about PCP, angel dust, giving people superhuman strength. And I'm going, look, it, giving people superhuman strength, why would we believe such a thing? And Carl Hart, who's absolutely focused on that as a specific problem, says there isn't a single study that shows that PCP heightens aggression, let alone any drug making us superhuman, you know, getting us to lift cars or do stuff like that. And it, how much the mythology is wound in, and I think we have to be very careful about this from all directions, you know, the mythology of how bad drugs are for us and the mythology of how good drugs are for us, the amount of anecdote. But in the end, I think there's a reality, which is that human beings are going to take drugs. Even Mormons actually do take drugs. They just don't take alcohol, coffee, or various other things. But I'm told there are things that they do take. And so many foodstuffs, of course, actually, you know, if we looked at something like aspirin, which is a potentially fatal drug and an incredibly helpful drug and was first taken from willow bark, but it also, you'll find it in grapes and apples. You'll find resveratrol, which, you know, a long time it said, have a glass of red wine a day because you're getting this resveratrol. And of course, you can get it from grape juice. It's nothing to do with the alcohol. It's from the red grape, dark grape. It actually produces this stuff. These drugs and the interactions of these drugs in an individual mind are going to be very different. I have a number of friends who over the years have told me how wonderful ayahuasca is. And
yeah, right.
And they, you know, claim that they had tremendous experiences and they found it, you know, very helpful. And I also have friends who didn't, you know, who took it and thought it was horrifying. So that again brings us back to the, if you're going to do this, especially if you're going to take something really strong like ayahuasca or ibogaine or ketamine, things that can throw you into another world, you know, way beyond what LSD and the other hallucinogens do, then you need to be very careful about who you take it with, where you take it, and you should always, you know, understand what the substance is you're going to take, always source it from the best place. And if possible at all, have somebody really experienced, not only in what that drug does, and they don't necessarily have to have taken it to have that understanding, but also in how to help you if anything goes wrong, you know, if you have a bad trip.
Yeah, that I think, right, this is has to be so individualized because our own chemistry and brain connections are different. And, you know, in psychiatry, we keep trying to get to this concept of precision psychiatry, which is the right drug at the right amount at the right time for a particular individual, get away from this idea of Prozac's going to help everybody who has some sort of emotional distress, that things have to be much more individualized. We haven't gotten near there, but I think this that also applies to general substances in the world, including food. And, you know, food can also have mental effects, let alone physical, and what you eat might affect your mood. But so what makes it so hard is you have to use the knowledge that is out there, but also recognize your own individual physiologic structure and what affects you in what kind of way, which makes this so hard. And research is crucial to get some general information, but so much has to be individualized, and where you say have some help around you to understand this is really important. And by the way, just a plug for Dr. Hart. I do know him and of him, and he won the same award I'm supposed to get next year, the Humanitarian Award for the American Association for Social Psychiatry. He won it maybe 4 years ago for the work you mentioned. So tremendous work, and so important because it came out of somebody from the Black community, you know, so.
And the poor Black community, you know.
And poor. So, yeah. you know, in some ways it's good to have an outside observer, but when it comes from somebody who doesn't really appreciate the culture they're looking at, that has its drawbacks. So it was so valuable to have someone like Kim. You know, cocaine's an interesting, since we touch upon it now and then, cocaine is so interesting because there was a time in the United States where it was very prominent, both in the Black community and in the very wealthy. And that seems to have dropped off dramatically in recent years, and it's not even clear why. Does it have something to do with the criminality behind it dissipating, that it didn't become as profitable as it once was? Did somehow the communities realize there really were big dangers of using cocaine? But it's faded into the background, which is sort of fascinating and important, and I think good. You know, I had patients who were addicted to cocaine, and they were so difficult to treat and got into so much trouble. One of the worst drugs out there, for sure. So,
yeah. And it's interesting in this country, I mean, the UK, that the media every decade bring forward another horror story about crack cocaine, and it just doesn't seem to catch on here. People just don't seem to like it, you know, for some reason. So the marketing's gone all wrong. You know, the Colombian marketing system is not functioning.
Probably it, yeah.
And I think I was very interested, you know, as America, and we have prohibition of cannabis around the world because of the United States. In fact, most of our drug prohibition came out of things like the Harrison Act in the United States. And in 1977, when the Dutch decided to, in fact, decriminalize cannabis, the use of cannabis, not the supply, it was said at that time that the reason they couldn't legalize was because America would put sanctions on them. So there was this control from above. So it's quite curious to see that it's the United States where you have now, I'm not sure how many states now, I think 30 have decriminalized for medical use and 11 or 12 have legalized.
That's about
and
right, yeah.
Finding their way into that. So with Colorado, they had the first year of settling in, and then the second year, they started to give us some numbers. And the crime rate went down, violent crime went down. The use of alcohol plummeted. 11% less alcohol was sold in the second year.
You've seen marijuana instead, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's interesting, but we still have to be wary. You know, I generally think that cannabis is one of the better and safer drugs, but that doesn't mean there are people for whom it would be an awful thing, be a dreadful thing, be traumatic for them. And it shouldn't be, you know, probably shouldn't put it in the water, but then, you know, it's oil soluble, so it'd be fine then. But that it seems with cannabis that now, you know, there are hundreds of papers have been written now about the therapeutic effects of cannabis. As we go back, it's been used as a treatment for epilepsy, and there are two forms of epilepsy for which nothing else works. And we've come to this conundrum in the UK where there was a little boy who was fundamentally, if he doesn't get cannabis, he has constant epileptic fits. And we got to this curiosity in law that under UK law, cannabis has no medical benefit. And he goes, so you can, you know, we're currently legislating. We've just heard from our parliament that Rwanda is a safe place, and they've ruled this democratically. They've voted on it. So now Rwanda is safe. However, people in Rwanda don't seem to share the opinion of British politicians.
Don't have that experience, yeah.
But the law had to be changed, and was changed in 2018. It's the only real refinement of our drug law since 1971, when it had to be, Parliament had to vote and say, well, yes, it might have medical benefits, because there were kids who were dying if they didn't get this substance. And we don't understand that thoroughly. But the idea that research has actually been banned. So kind of going, you know, in the 1990s, it was found that we produce anandamide, the bliss giver, ananda, in our own systems. And this is a complete analog of the Delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, THC. we make the stuff in our own heads. So we're all committing the crime of possessing the stuff, and it should be stopped. Human beings should all be arrested until they don't produce any more cannabis in their heads. Yeah. What was then discovered with the endocannabinoid systems? We know that there are two of them in the body. There's possibly a third one. And that these actually regulate more functions in the human body than any other system, but they can't be fully researched because there's an illegal drug involved that we produce in our own bodies. It gets very confusing. And there's nothing for Big Pharma to get into because you can't patent cannabis. You know, there are three or four, Nabilone, Marinol, there are various forms of it, Sativex, that are available and that have got tenuous trademarks and patents on them, but they're really just mixtures of cannabidiol and THC generally. And we're finding, we also know that cannabis has more than 60 active ingredients in it, but there hasn't been the research done to find out what which ones are doing. And that would research would have to come from the public sector, because there is no profit for the private sector medically in cannabis, I don't think. And that leads us to a real conundrum that it might be better. I've read that in the 19th century, when the hypodermic needle became all the fashion among physicians, that cannabis started falling out of favor because the opioids could more readily be translated into something you could inject. Whether that's a good thing or not, I'm not totally sure. But it meant that a really horrifically dangerous set of drugs, dimorphine, as it's called in medicine, or heroin, as it's called on the street, the opiates, the natural opiates and the opioids, the synthetics, are now killing so many people in the United States. And part of that is because they were used as a replacement medically for cannabis, and cannabis was sort of phased out, even though it was, of course, quite legal in the United States until the late 1930s and the Marijuana Tax Act.
You know, and you just mentioned some of the medical opioids that end up getting abused, and probably abused when the drug companies knew how dangerous they were. I think marijuana is such an important subject matter. I mean, they're not, I don't think, should be considered to be a psychedelic, but I think marijuana shows the potential wisdom of the public, right? I mean, because it has been federally banned. It never went away from usage. Large numbers of the public continue to use marijuana because it had so many helpful effects. And you know, depending on the political climate, it was easy to get away from that or not. I would say, as a clinician, when I would see some patients who wanted to stop marijuana, heavy use, they actually had much trouble doing it. What kind of addiction or dependency that is, I'm not quite sure. But it isn't necessarily easy to get off of it if you want to. What's beautiful about the current situation, you know, is now the dosage is being better regulated, and we're finding out about all these other related substances that have good effects on the body. So the plus is there. I guess I'll share my own individual experience, which I guess also shows why I'm somewhat cautious about this. And it has to be individualized. So way back when I was starting my psychiatric residency, I started to use marijuana for the first time recreationally because some friends used it and wanted us to try it, my wife and I did, and it was fine. And but then we were asked, do you want to take a little stronger dose of it? It's called hashish. And naive me said, okay, sure, it's just a stronger version of marijuana, right? Well, it was dramatically different, and I went into a dissociated state for weeks. And this was right during my psychiatric training. It couldn't have been at a worse time. And it was such a scary experience. Eventually it went away with some psychotherapy, and I think just time of dissipating in my body. But it that ended up, I decided I'm never going to use street drugs again, you know, whether it's marijuana or a psychedelic, whatever. I'm just not going to use anybody because I don't really know what's going to happen. And this experience was so devastating. But then again, I don't know what was in it. Maybe there was some other, you know, substance in it that I didn't know about, but it was really very scary. And again, pointed out to me how important an individual person's reaction to the substance can be, and much caution has to be used.
How this was an effect that lasted for weeks after you'd last taken it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I kept working, but I thought I was crazier than the patients. It was like, I would be talking to patients and having these dissociative sort of hallucination kind of experiences as I was doing so. And the only person who could comfort me was my wife, but of course she didn't come with me to work. But when I was awake, these scary images kept reoccurring and reoccurring. I couldn't focus on reading or anything else. And I probably just got through work by what I knew almost automatically helping. You know, I could still work with patients, even though I couldn't think straight. So after about 2 or 3 weeks of these dissociations, I finally told my supervisor in the residency program, I thought I was going to get kicked out, but he was very kind, understanding. And he said, well, maybe you need a therapist too. And so we'll find you one to help get out of this. I think he was thinking maybe this wasn't all drug. Maybe it was something else. And so I went to the therapist, went a couple times a week for a while. And both during that time, as well as obviously not using anything anymore, the total time till I felt like myself again was about six, seven weeks after usage. And then I was back to normal. Now, I can put myself in that state of mind again if I want to. Don't want to, but I know I can do it. It's still lurking a little bit in my deep unconscious. And the images I saw, I can still pull out, but I won't.
Nice.
But I was more or less normal ever after that. So it took probably close to 2 months.
That's really interesting. I mean, Charles Baudelaire blamed his psychosis on cannabis. And I think probably that he was in the tertiary stage of syphilis, had a bit more to do with it. But he wrote a remarkable piece about his first experience with cannabis, which I read. I was a teenager and fascinated by this as a subject. And it later became clear that what he'd taken was a substance called Majun, which is a very sophisticated form of cannabis that was used in the Middle East and had been for some time. And Majun is actually made with a little bit of Datura in it. Mm-hmm. So you have a drug that is, from my perspective, you know, I've had to look at Datura in some detail in the last few months because Tex Watson, who led the Tate LaBianca murders for the Mansonites, had taken a huge, enormous dose of Datura. And I've got into discussions with people because he used the word belladonna. So people have thought it was the deadly nightshade. And I'm kind of going, he uses the word Talachi, and a friend who's an ethnobotanist has pointed out that's Tala Oche, that's loco weed, Jimson weed, Datura. And of course, the thuggies were using Datura. So, and I was looking at them a couple of years ago, many years ago, when I was interested in the study of the science of cannabis. I read parts of the India Hemp Drug Committee report, which for a long time was the largest survey of drug use ever, 10,000 people, I think. And it was in the 1890s. And it had been, the idea had been put forward that cannabis was causing insanity. And so this huge project is set up, and they reported in the end that yes, it wasn't causing insanity, that they'd interviewed, I think, 500 psychiatric patients who were listed as cannabis psychotics. And they found that more than 200 of them had never taken cannabis. And it was the police who, from the symptoms they were seeing, said, oh, they're taking cannabis. It wasn't a doctor who was involved. The same mistake happened in Egypt in the 20s and caused the modern panic about cannabis. But at the end of the report, and it's an 8-volume thing, I just read snippets of it. At the end of the report, they said cannabis should remain legal in India. Alcohol should remain illegal in India, and Datura should be extirpated. It's the first time I remember seeing this word for pulling something up by the roots, getting rid of it, because the effect's so dangerous. So, you know, it seems unlikely to me that it would have been Majun that you had, and it probably was just a very strong cannabis resin with a very high THC level. And as you know, as we absolutely agree, different strokes for different folks.
Yeah.
And there are drugs that are just too powerful. They have too much of an effect. You had the disadvantage of an awful experience, but the advantage thereafter of a much better understanding of what psychosis is, I would think, you know, and how it feels to not have control over your own mental process and to be dissociated. And
You're right. Yeah, that's an interesting point, because over time, I ended up sort of specializing in treating PSD and the dissociative experiences that those patients have. I could understand those, be empathetic with it right away. It was somehow their dissociated experience from trauma were similar to what I got from whatever I took. It was, so yeah, it had certain advantages over time, you know. And actually, I like to experiment a little bit with taking psychiatric drugs at the time during psychiatric residency training, just to experience what the side effects might be like. So I took some Thorazine because that was still being used for schizophrenia and psychosis then, to see sort of why patients were complaining about it so much, because it did sort of work, but the side effects were horrendous. And yes, when I took a smallish dose, the side effect was horrendous. You just felt like a lead object was on your head. You were just being kind of buried and couldn't think and sluggish, and it was really bad. And so I tended to have, at that time, sort of this experimental way of finding out how I was affected by the same substances, you know, patients were treating besides anything else. But I never took, actually, after that experience, and I never took a psychedelic, so I have no idea how that might affect me. Nor do I have any desire.
No, me neither.
Try it, you know, now. I mean, it's like I sort of can't think of what benefit there would be to try something different now, you know. It's like I sort of have other ways to expand my mind and feel connections to people. And
you can listen to John Coltrane, right?
Yeah, that's great. Now you got it. That's right. That's my therapy.
That's great. A week or so back, I bought a disc. It came up on my feed, and I bought a disc, which is Duke Ellington and John Coltrane. And I'd never heard this before. And it is so
fantastic.
Utterly wonderful. You know, these two remarkable people with elements, you know, the bass player and the drummer from both bands. Sam Woodyard and Elvin Jones playing drums. Absolutely wonderful. And firstly, I applaud you for taking the substance that your patients were taking. I think that's a great thing to do, to understand what effect it will have. And certainly Thorazine was pretty horrifying in what it did.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it's an expression of compassion that you did that, and I think that's necessary. You know, to have the empathy, to compassion, the feeling together, the feeling that somebody else has. And, you know, as to what...
By the way, empathy, since you mentioned, I think empathy is so crucial for everybody, let alone psychiatrists who are trying to understand other people. But empathy has its limits. It's sort of what you do with the empathy that's so important. I mean, sociopaths, in my experience, have great empathy, great understanding of other people.
It's cognitive empathy, as it's called, problematic.
Yeah. And, you know, so in the world now, everybody's media mentions empathy over and over. It's so great to have empathy, and that'll help. Well, it may or may not. It is necessary, but not sufficient to be of help in relating to other people. It's what you do with empathy that's so important, I think. So,
I couldn't agree more. It's what, what's his name? Paul Bloom at Yale, a book called Against Empathy, The Case for Rational Compassion. And while I can't say that I found much in the book beyond the title, it's one of those books that, you know, he said it, he's got it down. That, but I read that having taken Simon Baron Cohen's empathy test and found that I disagree on about one of the questions, but I am 100% an empath. And it's, from my perception now, looking back, it's a disorder. You are put at a terrible disadvantage because you have this knee-jerk reaction to try and help people, and you feel overwhelmed all the time that you're not helping enough people, and it becomes self-sacrificing at a certain point. I mean, certainly, you know, 16 years of being harassed by Scientology was not as much fun as some people may think. But looking back, it was just people were coming to me who were wounded, and they had wounds that I knew, I learned gradually how to fix.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's still no professional discipline there. There's no training in psychotherapy to help former members of authoritarian groups.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, it can be harmful for somebody who's been involved in an authoritarian relationship, whether with a group or an individual. It can be harmful to them because somebody will get the cookie cutter out and say, oh, we're going to do transactional analysis on you, or psychodrama, or you know, existential, whatever, without actually having that major constituent of, which I call a therapeutic personality, which is an empathetic personality. So if you're going to, you have to be led by the client, you have to be, you know, taken to the place they need to go to. And of course, somebody who's been involved in such a group will interpret everything in the dogma, the doctrine, the beliefs of that group.
Yeah.
And so that, if you don't understand what the lens is that they're filtering through, and that's specific to every group, you know, the way a Muni or a Krishna or a Jehovah's Witness will react is quite different. You know, with anybody who's been in the Jehovah's Witnesses, you just go Armageddon and see how they jump, you know. So, but there will, you know, in with Scientologists, if you don't understand that the word reasonable to a Scientologist means the opposite of what it means to the rest of us, that it's a bad thing being reasonable. You're thinking about stuff rather than getting on and doing what's right. If you can find yourself in a very complex landscape, very difficult. But, and you know, returning to the question of empathy, one of the things that surprised me as I tried to understand this was the idea of the weaponized empath. The idea, because in Scientology, very definitely, there were two groups of people who were executives working for Ron Hubbard. One group were quite unpleasant, and I'm not going to mention any names. But I suppose I can mention Sibersky, because he's no longer with us. Beren Berez, who I think ultimately was busted for hauling huge amounts of drugs into the US. But they were mean individuals. They were bullies. And then the other side, you had these tremendously empathetic individuals. And, you know, several people I interviewed who'd worked doing awful things for Hubbard, criminal things at times for Hubbard. But they did it out of empathy, and yet caught up in that idea. If you can sell somebody on the idea that if we just got rid of all the Jewish people, everybody would be happy, mm-hmm. then you can con an empath into doing your work. I've suggested before that Heinrich Himmler, when you look at what he actually wrote and said, he expresses tremendous empathy for the Germans. And for him, that empathy becomes the need to destroy the Jews, the Romanies, you know, to suppress the Slavs or slaves, as the Germans thought of them. And it becomes utterly twisted into the urge to do good, and that good becomes redefined. And we see this, you know, if you look at the Crusades, you know, this awful period in history where, you know, the People's Crusade, which romps through Europe, killing every Jew they can find. And then they, of course, are not allowed into Constantinople because they're a rabble. And they then go and wipe out Christian communities in Anatolia because this is, you know, and then they themselves are wiped out by the Muslim armies. But it, you know, then up to the Fourth Crusade in 1204, where Pope Innocent III, head of Catholic Christianity, says, oh, goes to the Doge in Venice and says, oh, I need another crusade. And the Doge is, well, it's not really worth it anymore. We've completely pillaged the Holy Land. Why don't you take on Constantinople? So they go and sack Constantinople in one of the most vicious series of events. You know, the lions at St. Mark's in Venice were stolen from Constantinople at this point. And get this, how did they, is it just that there are psychopaths and thugs amongst us who revel in this? There's this other thing, which is persuading good people to do evil things because of some idea of, you know, and, which I'm sure is, you know, I'm very interested in the what was called the alt-right and is rebranding itself now, but groups like the Proud Boys or of course traditionally the Ku Klux Klan, and how these groups, they're not all psychopaths. There are people in there who are absolutely well-meaning and have come to believe terrible, right, absurd ideas, and then out of empathy are seeking to separate the races or do something like this. And we get this twisting together of empathetic and non-empathetic personalities. As you say, sociopaths, psychopaths have cognitive empathy. They understand other people's emotional process very well and can manipulate it. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, according to Baron Cohen, you have affective empathy, which is your own feeling and the feeling towards others, and how, you know, the word empathy starts to dissolve really somewhere in that as to what it might mean. But understanding the feelings of others and having strong feelings yourself. And there is, we're sort of caught up in that. As individuals, we have our own degree of empathy. I had somebody, because I've often encouraged people to take the empathy test just to see, you know, where they land and if there's something they ought to think about. Because, as I say, I think you can have too much and that rational compassion is a better idea. Why am I doing this? How will it be helpful? Should I sacrifice myself? Right. Is it more important that I look after the people that are close to me? Charity begins at home. How far should I extend myself? And I'm somebody who was, I was seriously overextended, you know, that it, I was, you know, I reckon it took me about 17 years to recover from the shock and the damage of trying to stand up to an organization with 40,000 members and $2 billion. It, you know, looking back, I'm kind of not very clever, really. You know, John, you know, but now I come to look at it, John. But it led me here into this wonderful conversation. I'm sorry.
David and 40,000 Goliaths, you were. Yeah.
But, you know, the Scientology is in decline. Although people seem to think that I'm still somehow, you know, I make comment about it, but I'm not really up to date with what's happening in it or particularly concerned. And because it just represents a way of behaving, you know, an authoritarian way of behaving, with which I disagree utterly.
Yeah. Nowadays, at least from my perspective, the societal, there's a wider societal concern about cultures thinking, which is what happens online and catches people. And so you don't necessarily need a live everyday connection with people in a cult. You can influence their thinking online, which is terribly difficult to counter nowadays, right? So and I think you're so right about the caution about, you know, empathy and trying to help. Another thing I was accused of at one time, which I think had some veracity, is a supervisor, administrator said to me once, "You have a rescue fantasy. You know, you have to control that better."
Yeah, me too.
Meaning I tried to maybe do too much to help patients and went across some boundaries sometimes in trying to help them. And I thought to myself, well, what's wrong with having a rescue fantasy? You know, people need help. But I came to realize maybe I was trying to do too much, you know, in certain situations and needed to pull back. And, you know, and I think that's a challenge all mental health clinicians have. How much do we try to rescue people? And over time, I came to this philosophy of I would tell patients whatever I knew about what I thought could help them, but unless they were in danger to themselves or other people, it was their decision about what to use of what I knew. And so if somebody came in, you know, for a medication review or even for a first time assessment, it was like, what do you think is going to help from what I told you? Is there something else that I didn't touch upon? The decision is yours. I'm just going to try to give you the information. I was trying not to, in a cultish way, influence what their decision was going to be. You know, I wanted them to have, I guess the term Steve Hassan uses is freedom of mind. That's what I wanted my patients to have. And that's what I wanted to try to enhance and use whatever my knowledge base was as a tool for them, you know, to decide. So,
yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, in this country now, the criteria is the person dangerous? Are they dangerous to themselves or to others? And if not, in part because of the incredible restrictions on public funding, which has been going on forever, that we can't put everybody into hospital. We shouldn't put everybody into hospital. I'm not going to go with R.D. Lang and his fantasies about mental illness, amusing though they were. And it is relevant, I think, saying, you know, what we define as mental illness, it is significant to the, you know, the extent that it's where somebody, you know, say a Cassandra, you know, somebody who can see the truth and is trying to warn us. One can see that Greta Thunberg could have been, and by some is viewed in that way, that her Asperger's syndrome, she's somebody I celebrate. I think she's a remarkable person who's done great things.
But
nonetheless, one can see that as a condition, and that perhaps circles back round to the idea that you can have a psychiatric condition and be of tremendous benefit to society. The Dostoevsky has to be the first person who leaps to mind. Undoubtedly, in any list of the 10 great novelists, there's Fyodor Dostoevsky. Incredible.
And well, you know, there's a book written by psychiatrist Nasser Gami, who wrote about how certain psychiatric conditions are a plus for being a leader if it's at the right time.
Yeah.
So somebody with manic-y symptoms may help in a time of widespread kind of lethargy, depression, recession in the world, and so on. And then at other times, a president or a leader who has certain psychiatric problems can be a detriment. And
like Richard Milhouse Nixon.
Exactly. And of course, now some of us are thinking about that once again with our presidential election, which is coming up in a year. What's the qualities of leader that will help the United States at this particular time or worsen the country? And then in the background, we have this Goldwater rule where psychiatrists can't publicly comment on a public figure without permission. And so how do we convey our knowledge that we think we have about particular leaders? We shouldn't, according to the Goldwater rule. So we have to find a way around that. Like, what's the qualities of a leader we need right now in the United States coming from psychiatrists? And then hopefully the public will understand how to apply that. I'm not sure that's a leap of faith, but it's so important because obviously it looks like who's going to run for president in the United States. There are going to be two dramatically different people and leaders, and their effects on the country will be enormous. And
on the world.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. And of course, you contributed to the landmark dangerous case of Donald Trump, which Bandy Lee edited, which is
I wasn't naming names, John.
No, I noticed. I noticed that.
You don't have an ethical prohibition to do that professionally.
You contributed to that book, but you didn't make an assessment of Donald Trump's psychiatric health. So you didn't violate the Goldwater rule.
Right.
And bless you for that. I have tremendous concerns. Anybody who has the political gene is dangerous. Anybody that wants to be a political leader is dangerous. And that's a conundrum that occasionally we have.
We have this idea, which I think is true from biographies and autobiographies of presidents and leaders. You need a certain amount of extra narcissism, even want to be a president with all the problems that come with it. So it's like, how much of that is helpful and in what way? And then when does it become a problem? And then if other psychiatric characteristics are involved, like sociopathy or attention deficit disorder, and you combine that with extra narcissism, well, what do you get then? Is that a leader that'll fit our times or make it worse?
Emory University did a survey of 20th century presidents, said the successful ones were all narcissists. And we're in trouble there with that word already, because I don't think what they were saying was that they were malignant narcissists. I think they were saying they were self-involved, self-promoting people.
And good point. Right.
There's so much conflict in that, looking at the private lives of many political leaders. It's shocking. I mean, the FDR, and I'm, I think the New Deal is one of the great points in human history, and it's a collective thing. It's not that Roosevelt dreamed this up and did it. They're a group of remarkable people, and then we look at his life and we say, well, he was an alcoholic who was in terrible pain from polio, terribly courageous man, but he also had a harem of women, including one of his own. I think she was his great niece, and there's a movie with Bill Murray in Hyde Park on Hudson, I think it's called. And Murray's performance is unbelievable. I mean, I accept that he's one of the great clowns of the generation. He's also a great serious actor, and apparently quite difficult to be around. Some people say, I don't know, and I don't care, because I don't have to be around him. But here we find that this great niece, I think, of Roosevelt was pulled into the harem. So again, this is awful, the morality here. We have to be practical about politics. We have real politics. And that looking at the series of of leaders, you know, in this country and in the US, there are problems. I mean, what's happened in the last couple of days, and we're going to have to conclude at some point, much as I love talking to you, because this could just go on forever. It's such a wonderful thing. But when the Pope made this statement about Israel, what Israel is doing being terrorism, how does that impact on the current Roman Catholic president of the United States? You know, how many factors are there involved here? And how can we change the political process towards something less plutocratic? You need $1 billion to be president, and more democratic, without it becoming populist, without it going to the other extreme. And I think that's a real struggle, and something that, you know, my work is against authoritarianism. It's against the idea that some people are gods walking among us and should be able to dictate what we do. Führers is another word for that. And that there are people who, and I think the majority of people, probably about 60% of people, who just give in to that and say, well, you know, Stalin knows what's best for us, or whoever their elected figure is. The adulation of Mao Zedong in China to this day horrifies me. This man, you know, the greatest mass murderer in all history. Perhaps 70 million people die because of Mao. And yet there are these huge pictures of him in Tiananmen Square, and this reverence in a country that supposedly has no religion. So, you know, so my problem is authoritarianism, wherever that raises its head.
Yeah. So, you know, if you look at the two major wars going on right now, Israel against Hamas, and Russia against Ukraine, who's the least authoritarian leader? Now, again, I'm not supposed to comment on that, but I think it's obvious who that is. And maybe that fits the country that's in difficulty right now. But it's the kind of leader I personally admire in the long run, I think helps the most. And maybe three of the leaders are much more in the authoritarian spectrum in what's going on. And when you have two different leaders from different countries who are fighting each other and they're authoritarian, then you run into big obstacles. And for an outside person like the Pope to make a comment like that, I think is ultimately very destructive. You know, it is hard to know what's the best process to come to peace and a better future here. But I don't know if how much an outsider can understand what's going on and not fall into, you know, traditional simplistic ways of looking at things.
Yeah, it's a contentious subject, but it's fascinating that the leader of the largest group that the world has ever known, the Roman Catholic Church, 1.2 billion people, five times bigger than the Orthodox Church, which is its nearest rival, bigger than the population of India, that influence. And it's interesting, you know, perhaps because Pope Pius IX and his emissary, who became Pope Pius X, actually put Hitler in power by telling the Catholic Workers' Party to give their votes to Hitler in 1933. That, you know, Pope Frank has been quite interesting. I really haven't been very keen, you know, since Vatican II, haven't really seen much progress in the Catholic Church. So he's done things. He's tried to deal with the corruption at the Vatican Bank, for example, and all the mafia money that was going through it. He's not dealt with, you know, homosexuality within the clergy. And that is, in the Vatican City, that is a very important issue. There's no doubt about that.
I know we're running out of time, but you mentioned homosexuality, and I just have to mention, it's Friday was the 50th anniversary of the American Psychiatric Association going towards removing homosexuality as a diagnostic category. Yeah. It finally happened completely in 1987. And why is it so important to recognize that? I just wrote the column today about that for Psychiatric Time. Because, in my view, homophobia was one of the important social psychopathologies.
Yes.
And it's been helped. It's dissipating over the years. You know, we now have gay marriages allowed and so forth. And if anybody says you can't help reduce a certain social psychopathology, whether it's anti-Semitism, homophobia is an example that it can be overcome. And it's crucial to remember this and celebrate this 50th year anniversary. And even psychiatrists can learn something that'll help move this along. It took gay psychiatrists to lead the way, but fortunately other psychiatrists joined in eventually. And it's a great societal triumph, I think. And there can be others.
Yeah, and it's something that's happened in the Anglican Church. It's happened in some of the churches, though it's caused division. But the Catholic Church is still holding tight to this idea, and also, of course, celibacy among priests, which only goes back 1,000 years. It, you know, a mere 1,000 years. It was the Orthodox way is that you can be a monk and celibate, and a priest, but you can also be a priest and married. And I think that we've seen the psychopathology that's been caused by enforced celibacy. And
yes,
you know, that again is one of the remarkable transitions of our time to start looking at, you know, sexual offences that are committed within, you know, the hallowed halls of religion and pointing Absolutely. Those things out, which is a transformation that has happened within the Catholic Church. I remember when Pope Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, he finally apologized, and that was the first step. But the church didn't then do anything really to change. And we've now moved along a bit. But yeah, so maybe if they all took LSD, you know, and chilled out a bit, and who knows?
Yeah, right.
You'd have thoroughly dissociated politicians. You know, and of course, there is, you know, to finish off, of course, we looking at the medical reports on Adolf Hitler, a man who's called Adolf Hitler in America. He was taking cocaine. He was taking pervitin, which is a weird name for amphetamines.
Yes.
And he was also, you know, all sorts of bizarre treatments were being given to him. And in the last days in the bunker, of course, he was in drug withdrawal because he couldn't get these things anymore. So sometimes drugs can be a very bad thing. And we need to be careful when we're given to politicians.
Oh, and, you know, for the invasion of Israel that was done by Hamas, the soldiers that did the invasion were taking massive doses of amphetamine. Mm-hmm. So they may have been dangerous enough without that, but you know, what they did when they invaded and how they abused women and kids in the most horrendous ways, which I won't mention. It's out there now.
Too awful.
Amphetamines, you know, enhance that. And yeah, amphetamines are, as a whole, quite dangerous, even though they do help ADHD. Yeah. But when you take it outside of that circumstances, they can be very dangerous and just enhance violence.
Yeah, and I mean, the reason that soldiers of almost every nation carry amphetamines in their backpacks, and I presume the Israeli Defense Force among them, I think the French carry modafinil instead of amphetamines, but otherwise soldiers carry amphetamines so they can stay awake. And yeah, there are the side effects of staying awake, such as, you know, not being, you know, being dissociated, not, you know, so it goes to a bad place.
Yeah, it's like, is there a right dose to take that's very helpful versus causing problems itself? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's been an issue with pilots also over time, you
of
know.
Of course.
You know, is there a certain amount of amphetamine that's helpful versus harmful? And, of course, they're not supposed to take anything nowadays, but, you know.
Yep. Oh, well, here we are at the end of our Christmas talk.
Goodwill to everybody. Yeah.
Yes, goodwill to everybody. Absolutely, Steve. So always, I'm so lucky that I get to do this. What can I say? It's a wonderful experience to have your conversation, and thank you.
Oh, thank you. Same here.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.